So with that, I'll open to Q&A, and please type your additional questions in the chat box. We've been collecting the ones that you have been typing so far. And the first that I want to open with is from Abdrahman Diallo, asking, in a nutshell, what are the common types of gender-based violence specific to your agriculture that research has found? I think all of the forms of gender-based violence are present in the agriculture sector. We've certainly seen economic violence, who physically receives the income, who is even aware of what income exists and deciding how that income is spent. We've seen, income taken away. We've seen, there are well-documented gaps in resources, land, inputs, but we also do see physical and sexual violence. We see sexual harassment as well. We also see coercion. So I think it's all there, but I wanted to open to our presenters to talk about what any specific forms or surprises that they encountered in terms of the gender-based violence that they saw in their own settings. Rodrigo, Delina, Winfrida, did you want to say anything? Do we need to unmute you?
Rodrigo,
go ahead. Oh, thanks, Lynn. Yeah, I would agree with Krista. In our experience, and as I was mentioning in my presentation, we did encounter physical violence. I think that was happening more often. We've seen sexual harassment, certainly. We've also encountered several cases of economic violence, and I think this is coupled with more of psychological sort of violence in terms of diminishing the position of women in society. So I think that if we take a look, I mean, we've worked a lot with social dynamics, and we can discuss about social power at the village level and also personal power, which I think is two very different concepts. So what we have done in order to address the DD is, so social power is basically a result of a group of people or a person controlling, having a higher control over limited assets or resources comparing to other people. So in this case, I think that for the Nafaka example, the resource would be the social perception that there is in rural societies of women. And this always is against women. So men have leverage in terms of activities that women shouldn't do and activities that women should be doing. What we have done to tackle these different forms of violence is to work more on the personal power side. Personal power comes from the inner resources that a person has, whether these are, this can be confidence, this can be a set of skills, and also training through capacity building opportunities. And I think that we are trying to balance social power by increasing personal power.
Yeah, so for us, if you look around our region, particularly, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Please go ahead.
Okay. So top on the list is intimate partner violence, and that's quite an issue, even in the country as a whole. Then, of course, there's the attempted defilement or defilement. And by this, I also mean when you have teenagers who are below the age of 18, some actually having transactional sex rather than just children, toddlers or children below the age of 10 years. So that's also an issue. And just generally physical assault from man to woman without necessarily having any gender relations. So domestic violence and defilement.
Great, thank you for that. We have another question from Mariama Ashcroft asking about addressing land ownership for women's empowerment and integrating GBV prevention approaches. I have a background in gender and land, so I'm always happy when people want to integrate gendered property rights and gendered land rights into programs. And certainly that is a very, land ownership is a very foundational and potentially very impactful prevention strategy for gender-based violence and also good for economic empowerment in general. That doesn't mean it's right for every agriculture program to do, but certainly we've worked with a few agriculture programs who have done women's and gendered land rights training with women and men and found people to be very, very interested and found that to be transformational. So it's something that we certainly love to see. But again, it's a very, you know, it's an undertaking in itself to do. And then I think, Rodrigo, there were several questions about illiteracy. Did you want to address any of those and how that affected how you did your research and engaged communities?
Yes, thanks, Krista. It's a question that came up a lot, and I think it's something that I did not have time to mention during the presentation. So, we were providing diaries to farmers in which they needed to read the information that was there and also input data, so they needed to know how to read and write. In this process, what we did is we worked with literate farmers for the activity, and 2 weeks before we went to the village and started working with the couples, we conducted literacy trainings at the village level. So we selected, we invited everyone in the PO to participate in the activity, and we conducted a literacy test in which farmers would read a piece of text and then they would respond to a set of questions. So this was our first filter. We then went to review these documents and we realized that there were some farmers that couldn't respond to the questions. And the farmers that, let's say, passed were the ones who were included in the activity. But the journals or the diaries in itself, they perhaps need a higher level of comprehension than just reading and writing. As I was saying, farmers need to know how to categorize their activities into different categories. They need to know how to measure time use in general. So, well, we conducted 2 days trainings, and during the first training, we would provide, during the morning, we would explain to farmers all the concepts, what are the activities that into each of these categories, how should they go about to fill the journals. And after lunch, we would do a set of exercises. So we would use 1 or 2 days, and they would farmers would have to go through the process of recording their activities, as they would do once we provided the diaries. So this was also a way of ensuring that farmers were understanding the concept. In these situations, we had farmers that just couldn't make it. There were some other farmers that, and these were discussions with, we had discussions with the team leaders, in which they would tell us, okay, I can work with this farmer. Between this afternoon and the whole day tomorrow of training, I'm sure this person can get to the point we intend them to get. So that first day of training was somehow a filter to us. And what are the implications of this? As you realize, we just work with literate farmers, and we did a very thorough check to make sure that they had the abilities to complete data, because we wanted them to meet the highest standards in terms of data quality. And through this process, then we were not able to cover a population of people in the village, people that are illiterate. I also mentioned that we were working with couples because we wanted to understand the intra-household dynamics. So this means that people that were single or divorced or widowers could not participate in this activity. So what we're doing now, building on this time diaries activity, we concluded the data collection in September. So we're now going to roll out for every intervention that NAFACA conducts, no matter if it's a training in full armyworm or if we are in a demo plot showing farmers the yields of a specific variety, then we were planning to do an activity similar to the time diaries, but not with that level of complexity. We're just going to use pictorials Using, for example, grains of maize or rice, farmers are going to, based on those pictures, say, okay, I spend more or less time in this activity. I do more household chores, or I do more social activities. So we have found a way to adapt the methodology in order to include the population that with this pilot we couldn't include because of the requirements that they needed to have.
Thank you, Rodrigo. And I think your response also answers, to some degree, Kathy Fury's questions about quantifiable results, and that you guys are working on additional research, and hopefully in the coming months we'll have more to share. I want to turn a question over to Jen Williamson. This is from Loretta Burns. There seems to be an assumption that all agriculture projects have not been aware of gender issues or GBV. But very often, gender specialists do not understand agriculture production, and this is not new. Jen, do you have a response?
Yes, I think Loretta is raising an important issue that needs further clarification for us. So I think when we're talking about a learning agenda on gender-based violence in agriculture, one of the things that's important for recognizing about the drive for this learning agenda is because this is actually coming out of a demand from the agriculture sector. And it's not that agriculture projects have not been aware of GBV issues. It's precisely because they are aware of GBV issues. So she's raising, Loretta, you're raising a really important point, and you're absolutely right about that. The question is not whether GBV is happening, but how, what do we do about it, and how do we address it? And so the learning agenda is not just about identifying what to do, but identifying what some of that great learning is in the field and how we can scale it up. One of the reasons I mentioned reaching out to other sectors is because other sectors have been acknowledging and addressing this issue for a longer time. So some of them have scalable approaches, resources that we can learn from, but clearly we need to adapt it for the specific needs of the agriculture sector. But also combining that with the really important learning that's been happening in the field and on the ground. One of the reasons we titled this session the way we did is not just because of the holiday tomorrow, but also because our conversations with stakeholders and with implementers and donors have been that this is so scary. A lot of times, you're absolutely right, people are aware of this, but they don't know what to do about it. They're scared to talk about it, scared to address it. And so a lot of times, gender advisors know about it, but may not actually get the air and space to address it, the resources they need to address it, or other technical specialists really don't know who to reach out to or how to get the support they need. So we're excited that there is so much energy and interest around this topic, and what's new about it is actually the energy and the willingness to address it. So what we want to do as a project and as our learning agenda is to help facilitate conversations, to help surface existing learning and knowledge, and help bring this together so that we can identify those scalable approaches, identify those promising practices, and bring those knowledgeable actors together so that they can share it in a space where they feel safe. So you've raised an important and correct issue, but also we don't want to people to make assumptions about who knows what, because there are many gender specialists that do know agriculture, but may not know gender-based violence. And we also want to empower our agriculture and our market systems and our learning specialists to address these issues in partnership with other practitioners. So thank you for raising that issue.
Thank you to both of you for raising the issue and for responding so well. I want to turn now to a question from Gina Alvarado for Rodrigo, asking to know more about what elements of the project lifecycle and the project management allowed some of the lessons and some of the things you were seeing in the research you were doing to be integrated so soon without, you know, having to go through project reviews and evaluations, but really to integrate them more in real time.
Yeah, thanks. I think this is a very good question. And although I'm not going to be able to go in depth to respond it, I think there's a case study that has a lot of information step by step of this transition. But I think that the key edge were to push the concept of CLA at every stage of the project. So part of the studies that we conducted, as I was saying, most of them, in most of them, we engage enumerators. What we did for this study was a different approach. We used most of our staff, or most of the staff participated in not only the implementation, but also developing the concepts, developing the methodology, implementing and evaluating the results. Having a staff understanding the importance of this thought process at the beginning, seeing firsthand what is happening in the field, and then being able to come up with potential solutions has been a key part in this process. But to get to this point, what senior staff has done is, and I think it's been a very interesting process to really nurture a learning culture in the organization. So, we, as I was saying in my presentation, we included pause and reflect sessions. So these were spaces inside our regional meetings or monthly meetings where at each of the offices, not only at headquarters, we're in a specific location, but we have offices in five regions. At each of these locations, junior staff were very engaged in providing their experiences in the field and hypothesizing on what could be the cause for a specific problem and what were the potential solutions that he or she believed we could implement. So I think we really instituted a culture in which we tried our level best to make sure that no one was afraid to speak their mind in terms of failures or thinking that they would be wrong. So we also included this concept of collaboration, learning, and adapting into each of our quarterly meetings. We have two annual summits where we invite all the staff of the project, and we generate or create a learning agenda for the upcoming year. And in order to implement these things, they need to be budgeted. So we do have a specific amount of money budgeted to implement our learning agenda. So I think it's been a very integral process, and something that I think it's important to highlight is that our staff has really changed. I've been here in the project for about a year and a half now, and I've seen since the moment I arrived, and this is not because of me, but because of how the culture has impregnated into our team members. And you see that there is a more critical opinion at every step of the way. And we were able not to include this just as a part of our research targets, but you see that there is a learning culture in every process that we conduct as an organization, even internally. So, for instance, we have a finance paying a certain amount of money to farmers for participating in this activity. So we did provide to farmers something I didn't mention before, sort of a wage or a daily wage in at the end of the week. So they received 7 days of payment, and not for participating in the activity, but because of the time they were investing in the journals. And this would ensure high data quality. So when we began, and because we had to bring the payment sheets from the field, and there were couples, some of the couples only owned one phone number, and the phone number wasn't on the name of that person, it was on the name on another one, it was always very difficult to get this payment on time. So we initially started this process and paying farmers 2 weeks after they participated in the activity, and by the time we finished, we paid farmers in 48 hours. So we implement this learning culture and this transition to every activity that we conduct internally. And just to close, I think that what also pushes us to be able to implement this decision is as we go is that we have this sense of urgency for change. We have the evidence, and not amending our interventions, we'd be harming ourselves in terms of the impact that we can achieve. So I think that being able to institute a sense of urgency throughout the whole project, from senior staff to junior staff, has been a key part in this transition.
Great. Thank you so much, Rodrigo. I am mindful of time, so I want to quickly turn it over to Deline and Winfrieda to see if there's anything that they would like to add or to speak to.
Maybe just as an overall statement, I think you've asked us to join just to share a different perspective in terms of a global multinational and our perspective on this issue. I think it's just important for us that Unilever is strong on the journey of recognizing and coming to the fact that there is an issue that needs to be addressed. I don't think we're close to solving it, but it's a journey for us. And certainly for us, we take it as a very serious commitment that we will put as many programs as we need behind it to make sure that we support our employees and communities around it have a better place to live, better place to work, and that they are safe and healthy and supported. Do you want to add something, Denise?
I've just seen a lot of interaction around unpaid care work. And maybe just to speak to that, and also looking at the time diary, quite a writing tool to use. Maybe just two things that I thought would speak to that. We look at, for example, caring for the child or nurturing the child, breastfeeding, some of the unpaid care work that we have recognized as a business, the time that women go to look for food or they go to cook. For us, that is some of the unpaid care work that we find that keeps women away from doing other productive chores. So what we have done, for example, is we have a set of daycare centers across our plantations, and also put in what we call breastfeeding centers to allow women also to breastfeed and also keep their children safe during the day, so then they don't have to be rushing back to their house and miss out on their wages, and also give them the time during the day to go and breastfeed, which then is paid time for them when they go to breastfeed. That is part of our policy. So that also ensures that our women are not losing on their income because of the what we consider the unpaid care work. Then the other thing that we do is we also do bulk cereals. We bring bulk cereals to households every other month to ensure that women don't walk long distances or don't have to travel outside the plantations all the time to go and look for example, maize, which is really used to cook our staple food, which in our country we call like ugali. And the same happens in Tanzania. So we make sure that we also allow women to have time on their hands to do other productive things. Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much, Winfrieda and Deline. So I want to thank everyone for joining today and for being willing to talk about this topic. We were thrilled because for a topic that is so difficult and many don't want to talk about, we had a lot of interest and people willing to listen. And I very much appreciate both the Nafaka 2 project and Unilever being willing to so openly talk about what their processes and kind of reactions and how they've been working against gender-based violence in their own work has been. So thank you very much. In about a week's time, there will be a recording of this webinar available as well as the transcript. And have a wonderful morning, afternoon, and evening.